When you see something strange, how do you explain to yourself what you saw? What was that? What did I see? And if the answers amount to something that doesn't exist to your knowledge or that of others, where do you go from there? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I could have sworn I saw Bigfoot loping down Main Street the other day. It was dusk, and as I drove toward him, his figure loomed ahead in silhouette. I thought, well, that's odd. Bigfoot just walking down the street in the suburbs of Rhode Island on a Tuesday evening? As I got closer, however, I realized it was just a guy we call Seth who lives down our street and takes a couple of daily walks to the local Dunkin'. But for a minute there, I was excited to finally have my own encounter. Nothing spooky ever happens to me. I've never seen a ghost or even had one tug at my covers in the middle of the night. I've never seen an alien, and I've never seen a cryptid. I'd like to. I do want to believe. But at the same time, I believe that most weird things have a rational, non-paranormal type explanation. I am both Mulder and Scully. I am Skulder, if you will. Even when I took hallucinogens in my younger days, I never saw things that weren't there. Sure, colors got brighter and things sometimes swirled around, but I never sat there talking to an imaginary being that my mind had conjured up. I never pointed something out to friends who told me there was nothing actually there. I wonder if that's because the rational side of my brain won't turn off even with chemical help. The closest I've come to hallucinating, I think, was hearing new things in songs I'd listened to hundreds of times before, and I would think, I bet they put that in just for people who are high. Which is just about the most high kind of thought a high person can have. I bring this all up because the witnesses in our story today were teenagers in 1977, and while I have no evidence that they were indeed partaking in drugs, it's hard to believe they weren't, all things considered. It was the 70s, man. And before we get started, this story takes place in Dover, Massachusetts, so you better believe I will be doing the accent, and not very well at that. So if you're one of those people who hates it when I do silly accents, you have been warned, and I urge you not to email me about it because I don't care. Life is really hard right now, and if I have the opportunity to do a bad Massachusetts accent, I'm fucking gonna. It was 10:30 p.m. on April 21st, 1977. Hopefully, 17-year-old Bill Bartlett had an 8-track in his Volkswagen. Sources don't reveal what model Volkswagen this was, but one has to assume it was a Beetle. Otherwise, he and his two buddies, Mike Mazzocca and Andy Brody, were likely blasting something flaccid like Manfred Mann's Earth Band's Blinded by the Light. The number one pop single that week was David Soul's Don't Give Up on Us. Ever heard of it? Me neither. I looked it up so you don't have to. It's awful. Truly a very bad song.
Don't give up on us, baby. We're still worth one.
In fact, looking at Billboard's list of number one pop songs for that year is a study in just bad music. With the exception of a small handful of songs like Stevie Wonder's Sir Duke and Dreams by Fleetwood Mac, 1977 was an awful year for music. Fortunately for the young trio, the everlasting gobstoppers of auditory nightmares such as Hotel California and You Light Up My Life were still a few months away from assaulting ears everywhere. Anyway, my point is, Bill, Mike, and Andy were out for a late-night drive, likely listening to something pretty bad on the car stereo, perhaps passing a doobie, when Bill noticed something on the side of the road up ahead. He later told the Associated Press that at first, I thought it was a dog, but when it looked back at me with bright orange eyes, I knew it wasn't a dog. Bill would go on to describe the creature to cryptozoologists and authors Lauren Coleman and Jerome Clark. The story was covered in a piece for the Milford Daily News in 2005. According to that piece, Bill said that when the creature turned its head and looked into the headlights, it had, quote, two large, round, glassy, lidless eyes shining brightly like two orange marbles. Its watermelon-shaped head resting at the top of a thin neck is the size of the rest of its body. Except for its oversized head, the creature is thin, with long, spindly arms and legs and large hands and feet. The skin is hairless and peach-colored and appears to have a rough ore, like wet sandpaper, Bartlett subsequently tells Coleman. Standing no more than 3.5 to 4 feet tall, the figure is shaped like a baby's body with long arms and legs. It had been making its way along the wall, its long fingers curling around the rocks, when the car lights surprised it, end quote. Apparently, this sighting happened so quickly that Bill didn't even have time to say, check it out, or anything. Instead, he sped up and, I took that corner at 45, which is pretty fast. I said to my friends, did you see that? They said, nah, describe it. I did. And they said, go back, go back. And I said, no way, no way. When you see something like that, you don't want to stand around and see what it's going to do. Speak for yourself, Bill. Call me a scolder, but I would 100% want to stand around and see what it's going to do. Chance of a lifetime, that is. They finally got me to go back, and Mike was leaning out of the window yelling, come on, creature! And I was saying, will you cut that out? Andy was yelling, I want to see you. LOL. Men. Always be out there menning. Nothing makes a small creature want to come and hang out more than a car full of men yelling for it to. Works with me every time. And what am I, if not a small creature? So when Bill gets home, his dad notices he's acting a bit off and asks him if everything was okay. Bill's like, I saw a creature! Okay, now this is all coming into focus. Sounds like Bill smoked some extra potent jazz cigarettes and his dad was like, are you high? And Bill was like, what? No, I don't do pot. I'm acting this way because I just saw a monster. Yeah, that's it. It was a monster.
Yeah, that's it, ticket.
Bill, who had become a professional artist, drew a picture of the creature he saw on the side of the road and then made a watercolor of it. But wait, maybe I was too quick to judge. Maybe Bill wasn't either seeing things because he was high or making up that he saw something to get out of being caught for being high. Because it turns out that about a half hour after Bill saw this baby-bodied, glass-eyed, and possibly disproportionate creature, 15-year-old John Baxter was walking home on Miller's Hill Road, about a quarter of a mile from where that road intersected with Farm Road, where the three boys in the VW had been driving, when he saw something or someone approaching. According to the Milford Daily News piece, quote, because the figure is short, Baxter assumes it's an acquaintance of his, M.G. Bouchard, who lives on the street, end quote. Apparently, Bouchard had an enlarged head from a childhood illness, but I guess also he was only about 3.5 feet tall? Anyway, as John tried to get a better look, he called out, but the figure darted off down across a gully and up the opposite bank. It was then that John realized the thing was too short to be his friend, and he thought it might have been a child. According to an episode of the Strange Animals podcast on the incident, John didn't hear any splashing as the creature crossed the gully, and so assumed it had leapt clean across it. I don't know what kind of gully we're talking about, so I don't know how impressed we should be, you know? Was it a foot wide? 10 feet wide? Who knows? I suppose it must have been wide enough that John noted the feet, which means this thing could either jump real good or perhaps fly? About 30 feet away on the opposite bank of the gully, John said the creature stood, and even though it was in silhouette against the moon, John said he could tell its feet were curled around the rock it stood on, almost as though its toes molded to the shape of the rock. While the Milford Daily News described the creature as standing on a rock a few feet away from a tree, Kate Shaw, host of the Strange Animals podcast, recounted the creature had its hands wrapped around a small tree, similar to how its feet were wrapped around the rock. So while Bill thought the creature looked like a baby with a watermelon-shaped head, John thought the body looked more like that of a monkey and its head was shaped like a figure eight. Or, if I might editorialize here, its head was shaped like a peanut. After a few moments of staring into the creature's glowing eyes, John got spooked and ran off. The next night, April 22nd, around midnight, 18-year-old Will Tainter was driving 15-year-old Abby Brabham home along Springdale Avenue, which also intersects with Farm Road about a mile and a half from the intersection with Millers Hill Road. When Abby noticed a small creature with a thin, monkey-like body and an oblong head crouching by the road. According to the Strange Animals podcast, quote, "At first, Abby thought she was looking at an ape, but it had a tan body without hair, a large watermelon-shaped head, and glowing green eyes. Will saw the creature too, although not as good a look as Abby. Abby estimated that the creature was the size of a goat," end quote. Will only saw the creature for a moment, but the impression he got was the same as those before him, something tan with a large head that was definitely not a dog. But, actually, he was unimpressed enough with it that later he said he doubted he would have even looked twice at it if Abby hadn't said something. And that would have been that, except that just about 1 week later, just the right person just so happened to ask just the right person what must have been just the right question. And pretty soon, news of the Dover demon began to spread. Strangers, I'm not gonna lie, I love bread. It's something Oprah and I have in common. I love a bread with butter and jam. I love a bread with my soup. I love a bread with cheese and herbs in it. I love a cheesy biscuit. And that's why I'm in love with Wild Grain. Wild Grain is the first ever subscription box of healthy, delicious breads, pastries, and pastas. Whether you're a savory person like me, or you like a blueberry scone for breakfast, or a little cherry hand tart with your lunch, or a chocolate lava cake, are you kidding me? Wild Grain has an amazing selection of carbalicious treats. Everything bakes in 30 minutes or less and is made with ingredients that are better for you than traditional grocery store breads. Wild Grain's boxes are fully customizable. In addition to their variety box, they have a gluten-free box, a vegan box, and a new protein box. Imagine having fresh, bakery-quality bread, pastries, and pasta at home without any trips to the store. And don't just take my word for it. They have over 40,000 five-star reviews and have been voted the best food subscription box by USA Today for 3 years in a row. For a limited time, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants for life when you go to wildgrain.com/strange to start your subscription today. That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life when you visit wildgrain.com/strange, or you can use promo code STRANGE at checkout. On April 28, 1977, cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman, who lived in Needham, Massachusetts, less than 4 miles from Dover, was shopping at the Dover Country Store, where he struck up a conversation with employee Melody Fryer. I have no idea how exactly the conversation went, except that I assume Coleman told Melody he was a cryptozoologist, to which Melody had to have replied, "What the fuck even is that?" Or Coleman was like, "Say, you wouldn't happen to know about any cryptids in the area, would you?" To which Melody would have had to have replied, "What the fuck even is that?" Otherwise, Melody just happened to tell a cryptozoologist about a cryptid her friend Bill had just seen a week prior. Anyway, it literally doesn't matter at all. What matters is that Melody told Coleman about Bill's encounter with the tiny ape-like creature with the gigantic head and told him Bill had drawn pictures, which, of course, Coleman was keenly interested in. And 2 days later, Melody managed to get Bill's drawings into Coleman's hands. By May 5th, Coleman had interviewed all four teenagers, Bill, John, Abby, and Will, who had claimed to see the weird watermelon-headed monkey creature. And by May 16th, word had already spread enough that the Associated Press came sniffing around for a scoop. I don't know how or why the police became involved. Indeed, at first, local police were ready to write the whole thing off as a hoax perpetuated by some bored teenagers with nothing to do over spring break. Lord knows there wasn't any good music on the radio to listen to.
Don't give up on us, baby. We're still worth one.
But Police Chief Carl Sheridan told the AP that it was Bill's account that gave him pause. Bill, said Chief Sheridan, was a, quote, outstanding artist and a reliable witness. I mean, the part about him being an outstanding artist is neither here nor there. Just because the guy can draw good doesn't mean he's honest. And besides, an outstanding artist would be able, I imagine, to draw a fantastical creature completely from their own mind. The police were so impressed with Bill's talent, in fact, that they hung his watercolor of the creature in the station. But it wasn't just Bill. The other kids were found to be reliable witnesses, too. According to an article in the San Antonio Star from June 19th of that year, high school principal Richard Wakely vouched for all four teenagers' credibility. He was quoted saying, "I don't think they were buddies who were in cahoots and cooked this thing up." The same article quotes Chief Sheridan saying, "None of these kids have any sort of record. I only know the Bartlett boy, Bill, and I can vouch for him personally." For his part, Lauren Coleman brought on a small team to investigate the matter. The team included Walter Webb of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, Joseph Nyman of the Mutual UFO Network, and Ed Fogg of the New England UFO Study Group. This, despite none of the witnesses mentioning anything about a UFO, nor there being any sightings in the area around that time. I guess, given Bill's outstanding drawings of the thing, it was assumed it was from outer space? According to the Milford Daily News, Coleman's investigation concluded, quote, "There's nothing in the witnesses' backgrounds to suggest they might be pranksters and much to suggest they were honest, upright individuals," end quote. Webb noted, quote, "None of the four was on drugs or drinking at the time of his or her sighting, so far as we were able to determine," end quote. Sir, you're asking teenagers to admit they were drinking and doing drugs. What'd you do, a breathalyzer and a pee test weeks after the incident? Come on. Webb continued, quote, "None of the principals in this affair made any attempt to go to the newspapers or police to publicize their claims. Instead, the sightings gradually leaked out," end quote. Well, sure, but couldn't it have also been that one kid's fib to cover for maybe being stoned, as is my working theory, got a little out of hand? It turns out that these kids all knew each other. That isn't really a gotcha fact. It was a small town. Everyone knew everyone, probably. But couldn't it be that Bill said to John, "Pro tip, if your dad thinks you're high, just tell him you saw a melon-headed monkey-like creature with glowing eyes. Trust me, it'll totally work." And then Will and Abby jumped on board too. Isn't that possible? Webb continues, quote, "Finally, the teenager's own parents, the high school principal, the science instructor, and other adults in Dover whose comments were solicited didn't believe the Dover demon was a fabrication, implying the youths did indeed see something," end quote. Or does it imply the adults were gullible? Quote, "As for the idea the witnesses were victims of somebody else's stunt, this seems most unlikely, chiefly due to the virtual impossibility of creating an animated lifelike demon of the sort described," end quote. Given the state of motion graphics in 1977, hard agree there, Webb. As for the teens being honest, upright individuals, I might argue that even the most honest and upright teenager is susceptible to gossip and peer pressure. And sure, seeing a cryptid is a weird thing to be peer pressured into admitting, but kids are weird. They're also not the most reliable narrators among us, and who can blame them? Seeing a strange creature while hormonally tweaking sounds like a recipe for blurry recollections, which many would later pick apart in the aftermath of this famed sighting. Strangers, there's a better way to buy blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery. It's called 3-Day Blinds. They are the leading manufacturers of high-quality, custom window treatments in the U.S., and right now, if you use my URL, 3dayblinds.com/strange, they're running a buy one, get one 50% off deal. Listen, we can shop for almost anything at home. Why not shop for blinds at home, too? 3-Day Blinds has local, professionally trained design consultants who have an average of 10-plus years of experience that provide expert guidance on the right blinds for you in the comfort of your home. Just set up an appointment and you'll get a free, no-obligation quote the same day. Right now, we are eyeing some brand new shades for our front door and stairway window. I love the selection at 3 Day Blinds, and I love that they'll bring samples so I can see what it will actually look like in my home. If you're not very handy, the expert team at 3 Day Blinds handles all the heavy lifting, from design, measuring, and installing, so you can just sit back, relax, and leave it to the pros. Right now, get quality window treatments that fit your budget with 3 Day Blinds. Head to 3dayblinds.com/strange for their buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery. For a free, no charge, no obligation consultation, just head to 3dayblinds.com/strange. One last time, that's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to the number 3dayblinds.com/strange. According to a piece called The Demon of Dover by Chris Pittman on the website Cellar Walls, which bills itself as a resource site devoted to all UFO sightings in Massachusetts, there are some major discrepancies between some of the statements the teens made in their interviews with Coleman and his team. The piece begins with this disclaimer, quote, "This article is entirely derived from the report Investigation into the Reports of an Unknown Creature Seen in Dover, Massachusetts, April 21st and 22nd, 1977, written by Joseph Nyman and dated January 28, 1978. Nyman was one of the original investigators of the case, along with Lauren Coleman, Ed Fogg, and Walter Webb. They interviewed each witness and conducted on-site investigations shortly after the events. I am very grateful to Joe Nyman for his generosity in letting me copy the report," end quote. In the piece, Pittman highlights specific differences in the witness statements. Quote, "In an interview on May 21, 1977, Will Tainter told investigators that he and Bill Bartlett were going camping on Friday, April 22nd, the day of Tainter and Brabham's sighting, when they picked up John Baxter hitchhiking. Tainter said, 'We were all just talking, and Bill happened to mention, oh, did you hear what I saw? And John goes, well, what? Because I saw something last night,' end quote." At which point, they compared their sightings. Tainter told investigators that he believed Bill's account because, "I know he wouldn't lie to me, and it didn't seem like a joke. He seemed really serious about it." But in an interview that same day, John Baxter told the story differently. He told the investigation team that he hadn't heard of the other sightings until Tuesday of the next week. "I was not aware of Bill's drawing until after, when I told some people I was talking to them. I think it was in school when we compared them. Because I was telling the story to a couple of kids, and someone came up and looked at my picture, which I was holding out, and they said, 'That looks like the one Bartlett saw. He said he saw something like that.' And I said, 'Nah, it couldn't be.'" This was, in fact, the first I'd heard of there being another drawing of the creature. And then, on June 11th, Bill Bartlett gave yet a third version of events. Bill said he didn't remember when he first saw John's drawing, but he thought perhaps it was the Friday after his sighting, so a week later, when the two teens bumped into each other in town and John was like, "Hey, check out this drawing I made of this weird thing I saw." And then the next night at a party, Bill had his drawing with him, but didn't remember if John had been there or had seen it. Pittman notes, quote, "So the witness interviews leave some confusion as to when the witnesses first compared stories. Note, Nyman's report does not address this apparent contradiction, but he includes Tainter's story about the meeting in the car on a timeline of the sightings, so it is apparent that he believes that story." To try to clear this up, I contacted Lauren Coleman, one of the three investigators. He told me that he believed that the witnesses had not compared stories until the following week in school, end quote. According to Pittman, Bill, John, and Will may not have been quite as honest and upstanding as some were led to believe. He notes that while a science teacher gave Bill the stamp of approval, quote, "Two other teachers, however, said that Bill was essentially a bad kid, and one of them said that Bill was just the type of person likely to perpetuate a hoax." He said that Bill and John Baxter frequently hung out in the school's smoking lounge. This seems dubious, however, as Bartlett had strong negative opinions about smoking. Also, there was a 2-year age difference between Bill and John, making mutual activities unlikely. Neither Bill Bartlett nor John Baxter nor Will Tainter were good students, which may account for the negative teacher opinion." End quote. Let's just pause here for a moment to ponder the absolute insanity that is a smoking lounge in a high school. By the time I was in high school in the mid-90s, our smoking lounge was at the coffee place down the street. Think Central Perk from Friends, but filled with blue-haired, disillusioned 16-year-olds bitterly complaining that Green Day wasn't real punk, as if any of us knew what the hell we were talking about. Anyway, let's take a moment to step out into the clear air of an ad break, and when we return, the skeptics light up their own rebuttals. Strangers, for years now, I've been telling you how much I love my Miracle Made sheets. And guess what? I still do. Miracle Made sheets are luxury quality that last. Their silver-infused fabric inspired by NASA technology helps regulate my temperature at night so I'm not waking up in a puddle of sweat. They also prevent almost 100% of bacteria growth, which helps you avoid colds and helps keep your skin clearer. Miracle Made sheets are so soft, they feel like 5-star hotel sheets, but for a totally affordable price. And it's not just sheets. Miracle Made has all kinds of bedding to keep you comfortable and clean and asleep. Upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/strange to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use promo code STRANGE, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/strange, code STRANGE at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. While Coleman and Webb and their peers were willing to believe these kids really saw something paranormal on a dark road in 1977, there are, of course, detractors. Let me begin this section by referring back to the Strange Animals podcast, since Kate Shaw, like myself, doesn't seem to be in the business of outright skepticism and debunking. Shaw points out that, quote, April 18th, 1977 was a new moon, which means that April 21st would have been quite dark, with only a thin crescent moon. Yet, both Bill and John reported seeing the creature's long fingers and toes wrapped around rocks. Bill did see the creature in his car headlights, but John was looking at it through the trees. I checked Google Maps Street View, and Miller Hill Road doesn't appear to have street lamps, so I don't know how John could have seen the creature's fingers and toes so clearly from 30 feet away on a nearly moonless night. End quote. Meanwhile, skeptics continued to amass their own pile of tidbits and facts and hearsay. A piece in the Boston Globe from 1996 titled "He Takes the Para Out of Paranormal" about skeptic John Horrigan notes that Horrigan claimed that a later investigation revealed that one of the witnesses admitted to having smoked weed before seeing the creature. But Horrigan doesn't give any further details as to who the witness was or to whom they made this admission. I mean, sure, that's my working theory, that at the very least Bill and his two buddies were stoned, but I'm not walking around saying one of the kids admitted to being stoned. I just think it's probably true. Also, not for nothing, but generally speaking, weed isn't hallucinogenic. Can it make someone make up a story about seeing a weird, glowing-eyed, watermelon-headed, monkey-shaped thing in order to cover for the fact that they are indeed stoned? Sure. But it usually doesn't make one actually see weird, glowing-eyed, watermelon-headed, monkey-shaped things. Apparently, Martin Kottmeyer, a so-called expert on UFO stories, dismissed the whole affair by positing that what the kids saw that night was a baby moose. In an interview for the Boston Globe in the 2006 article Decades Later, The Dover Demon Still Haunts, Lauren Coleman points out, quote, "Only two moose were reported in Massachusetts in 1977 and 1978, both of them in central Massachusetts. A yearling moose by that time in April would weigh more than 600 pounds and be bigger than the Volkswagen Bartlett was in. To have a bipedal moose with long fingers and orange skin and no hair and no nose would be more of a phenomenon than the Dover Demon, he said, end quote. However, Coleman was far more indignant in the comments section of the Milford Daily News piece, where he huffed, quote, "For one thing, I go over the various wrong-headed skeptical arguments and demonstrate, for example, the Dover Demon could not have been merely a physically impossible bipedal baby moose. I know my zoology and moose, and obviously farmer Martin Kottmeyer does not," end quote. Touché. Indeed, according to A to Z Animals, moose are born between late spring to early summer, typically May or June, and weigh between 28 and 45 pounds when born. They can weigh up to 500 pounds by the time they're 5 months old and can run faster than an adult human by the time they are a week old. So this would mean it was a premature baby moose that was somehow surviving without its mother. Otherwise, it would have been 10 or 11 months old and as big as, well, a moose. Let's not forget, too, that moose don't typically have six long fingers and toes on the end of each hoof. The Milford Daily News piece ends quite abruptly with the line, "By the way, a local newspaper dubbed the creature the Dover Demon," a fact Coleman also disputed by retorting, quote, "Perhaps someday the media will get their facts straight on who coined the Dover Demon. It wasn't the newspapers, dear Horatio, for it was I," end quote. Regardless of who coined the term, Bill Bartlett remains forever the first person to come forward with an account of seeing the thing, and for that, he is not thrilled. In an article for the Boston Globe in 2006, Bill said, quote, "I have no idea what it was. I definitely know I saw something. In a lot of ways, it's kind of embarrassing to me. I definitely saw something. It was definitely weird. I didn't make it up. Sometimes I wish I had," end quote. So what the hell was this thing these five teenagers claimed to have seen that night in 1977? Strangers, you know I think everyone should be in therapy always. But these days it feels almost impossible to find a therapist, let alone a good one, let alone one that takes your insurance. Rula does things differently. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 a person. But depending on your coverage, you could pay as little as $0 a session. It's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. And Rula is not just affordable. The experience is tailored around you. Other online therapy platforms might match you with the first available provider, whether or not they're the right fit. But Rula considers your goals, preferences, and background to provide you a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who are actually aligned with what you need. There's no wait lists, no frustrating back and forth. Rula makes it easy to find a mental health provider who's accepting new patients, and appointments are available as soon as tomorrow. Plus, Rula will stick with you throughout your journey, checking in to make sure your care is helping you move forward. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit rula.com/strange to get started. That's rula.com/strange. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget. Judging from the roster of talent Lauren Coleman brought into the investigation, it seems obvious that he, at least, thought the creature was extraterrestrial. The piece in the Milford Daily News says that Coleman's argument was that at the time, quote, UFO and creature sightings were abnormally frequent and often seemed to be connected. They often occurred in closely related times and places. Many of the creature sightings involved mysterious monsters with human-like forms, end quote. But the article also points out that Ted Blocher, who worked for the Center for UFO Studies and had collected more than 1,500 UFO accounts, said that the witness descriptions were like none other he'd heard before, making its veracity questionable. I guess your story is more likely to be believed if you say the thing looked like E.T. or whatever. I don't know. I'm inclined to think if someone was trying to perpetuate a hoax that they'd seen an alien, they would have said it looked more like, well, an alien. Although, not for nothing, most descriptions of aliens are of skinny-bodied, long-limbed, hairless humanoid figures with large heads with no protruding features, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't actually, sounds a lot like what these kids described seeing, no? Maybe it was just an alien child? Or an alien little person? A little alien? And what if it wasn't an alien? What then? In his book Listening Post, naturalist Sigurd Olsen posits that the Dover Demon might be a cryptid known to the Cree Nation of Eastern Canada, the Managishi. Managishi are, quote, little people with round heads and no noses who live with only one purpose, to play jokes on travelers. The little creatures have long spidery legs, arms with six-fingered hands, and live between rocks in the rapids, end quote. According to NativeLanguages.org, Managishi or Meimegwesi come from Ojibwe, Cree, Odawa, Algonquin, Innu, Metis, and Menominee people. Quote, Meimegwesi are small riverbank-dwelling water spirits. They are generally benign creatures, but sometimes blow canoes astray or steal things when they are not shown proper respect. In some Ojibwe traditions, Meimegwesi can only be seen by children and medicine people. In others, they can appear to anyone and may help humans who give them tobacco and other gifts. Most often, Meimegwesi are described as being child-sized and hairy, with a large head and a strange voice that sounds like the whine of a dragonfly. The Cree and Innu describe them as having narrow faces, and some Menominee storytellers have said that they have no noses. It is sometimes said that Meimegwesi were originally created from the bark of trees. Meimegwesi are said to carve symbols on rocks and sometimes carve small canoes for themselves out of stone. Some people believe that their name comes from the Ojibwe word for hairy, memi, since Meimegwesi are usually described as having hairy faces and bodies. Other people believe that their name is related to the word for butterfly, memengwa, end quote. That said, I will note that all four accounts from the Dover teenagers said the thing was quite hairless. The description of the large head reminds me of the melon head accounts from Connecticut, Ohio, and Michigan in the 1980s. I covered melon heads in a bonus episode a few years ago. I'll rerun it as a bonus next week in the main feed, but spoiler alert, it was theorized that the so-called melon heads were children who'd suffered a form of encephalitis that enlarged their brains. Of course, given the description of the thin body, it doesn't seem likely that a creature with these proportions would be able to keep itself upright for very long. Even a small child with a large head can have trouble with balance, and that's with a normal-sized body. I suppose that might explain why this particular creature was gripping onto the rocks and trees for dear life. On the Strange Animals podcast, Kate Shaw points out, quote, a more likely possibility is a young black bear. Bears do stand and sometimes walk on their hind legs, especially young ones. But bear paws are broad and flat, and their toes are close together, sort of like a person's toes. Not only that, bears have large ears, and of course, they have thick black fur. Bears do get a type of mange that can cause them to lose their hair, and a young bear with a case of mange that advanced would probably also be sick and possibly very thin. But hairless bears, in addition to looking very sad, appear to have small heads, and their ears stick out even more than usual, since they're not half hidden with fur, end quote. Or maybe it was an ape? Obviously, primates aren't native to Massachusetts, but it's possible someone had a pet or someone released or lost an animal from a research facility. Shaw does a good job of going over the pros and cons of the primate argument. In the pro column, she points out that monkeys have long, thin limbs and slender bodies with very dexterous fingers and toes. Both the creature and apes have no tail, and an adult male orangutan has large cheek pads slash throat pouches that could make their heads seem disproportionately large in the dark. On the other hand, almost all primates aren't nocturnal, so seeing one awake at night would be highly unusual, and most would flee up into a tree or something if confronted with, say, the headlights of a car. It almost definitely wasn't an ape, because someone would have likely reported a missing ape, even if it wasn't legal to own one. Monkeys and chimps usually don't have large heads. Monkeys also don't have tails. It's relatively obvious why it wouldn't have been a gorilla, and while an orangutan can have a large head, they also have very visible facial features. But for me, the biggest fact that debunks the primate theory is that primates' eyes don't shine in the light like, say, a cat or a deer's might. All four kids said the creature's eyes were glowing. Abby had also said the creature was about the size of a goat, and while goat's eyes do reflect light, there was nothing else remotely goat-like about the thing. For his 2011 story Siege of the Little Green Men, the 1955 Kelly, Kentucky incident, included in his book Tracking the Man-Beasts, Sasquatch, Vampires, Zombies, and More, famed skeptic Joe Nickel did extensive research into the famous Kelly alien incident, an alleged alien sighting in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, involving an entire family of witnesses and a gang of small angry aliens, and because of that research, ended up putting forth the theory that the Dover Demon was nothing more than a snowy owl. The folks at the Skeptical Inquirer agree. I know this might throw a big over the whole thing, but stranger, I think I might be inclined to agree. If you look at a photo of a snowy owl and compare it to what the kids described seeing that night, it's not hard to put the pieces together. Snowy owls can stand more than 2 feet tall, which, sure, isn't normally the size of a goat, but maybe Abby only had experiences with kids or miniatures? Their eyes definitely reflect light, they are nocturnal, and they have talons that can wrap around small rocks. And that would explain why John Baxter didn't hear any splashing through the gully when the thing crossed it and appeared on the other side. It simply flew over it. It is hard to imagine that all four teens mistook an owl for some kind of cryptid or alien creature. But we really don't know who told whom what and when, or who was under the influence of some wacky tobacco, or at the very least, some Miller High Life, the champagne of beers. And as Kate Shaw pointed out, it must have been really dark out there, and Lord knows the brain likes to play tricks on us, whether or not we've fed it any kind of mind-altering substance. Among all the visually striking phenomena out there, we humans may just emerge the strangest creatures of all for what we do when we encounter the indiscernible. Our ability to transform our recollections using very little information into fantastical hypotheses that then spread like wildfire and beget even more versions is a part of our oral tradition at this point. Perhaps instead of competing to prove who's right in the aftermath, we could better use our energy by just enjoying the wonder and fun that this sapiens quirk brings. The Dover Demon, whether a snowy owl, a water spirit, an ape, or a cryptid, ultimately became the conversation piece it remains today. And that's the truth. The rest is just fun to talk about. Think about it. You made it to the end of this podcast for a reason. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, what does it take to have an intergalactic romantic relationship with a silver fox zaddy from another planet? A disorder of the brain? An overactive imagination? Or maybe just a willingness to see what the rest of us cannot? Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by me, Daisy Egan, with research by Joe Gordette, production help from Becca D. Gregorio, and sound mixing and design by Jeff Devine. If you have an idea for an episode or want to submit a question for an Ask Me Anything episode, head to strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. I will write back. Eventually, I need an assistant. You can follow me on social media at Daisy Egan or follow the show at SNU Pod and Grab Bag Collab. Stay strange.
Thank you.